Good evening. Welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Sarah Holliday, the Library Events Coordinator, and it's my great pleasure this evening to introduce Charles Rowan Bye. Dr. Bye has actually been one of our most frequent speakers since we began offering events in the early 1990s. It's not surprising due to our patrons' enduring interest in classical literature and culture and his distinguished list of books, including Ancient Greek Literature and Society and Odysseus, A Life. As you're probably aware, his new book, My Husband and My Wives, is a bit of a departure from this tradition. But only a bit, and I don't mean because we all know what was up with Achilles and Patroclus back in the tents. Really, the author takes his own life as a text to explore, just as he might do with the Iliad, bringing to life a past culture with a central character whose motivations are occasionally hard to understand, as he himself admits, but nonetheless fascinating. Along the way, he says some wonderful, pertinent, and moving things about men, women, America, teaching, learning, and the capacity of everybody, from the ancients to the present, to rediscover and reinvent themselves again and again. Please join me in welcoming Charles Rowan Bye.
Thank you very, very much. I forget, you have to talk in this thing. That means you have to lower your voice and not shout. Can I talk louder and not talk through this thing? Oh, no, you have to have me talk into it. I forgot that. I have to do this. So I'm doing it. Now, I wanted to say to begin with that I do not for one minute believe that Patroclus and Achilles were having sex in the Iliad. I think that ridiculous book, I hope she's not in the room, some idiot thing that's come out nowadays that's best left to 17 magazine. It has nothing to do with Achilles and Patroclus. It is grotesque, which is not to say in later times. Aeschylus, indeed, we have a fragment, described Achilles yearning over the thighs of Patroclus, which suggests that they were quite close friends at that time. But that's not a Homeric idea, so get that. When you read the Iliad, don't. All right. Now, if I shout too much, it's going to take me a little while to get into this. I have trouble with these things, and I want to lower the voice to the right the right place. I want to bring up why I wrote this thing to begin with. After my second marriage ended, I, as a single man, moved to Cambridge, Massachusetts, and very shortly thereafter, I spent a considerable amount of time in New York City, and in that new persona, I spent a great deal more time with persons who identified themselves as gay than I had in the past, because I had been living as a married man despite my sexual interest in males. And this was meant that I exchanged stories of details of my life, and one of the things I pointed out to all these guys was that I'd been married, and they're, you know, that gays do that, and they're hiding out, and it so makes sense. And then I said, well, then my wife died, and I got married a second time. They go, what? That's grotesque. But twice is a perversion. And I said, well, I know it's a little peculiar, but I really was very attached to both of those women. And anyway, the fact of the matter was that I decided shortly into the 80s that I was going to write the story of my life up to that time and describe my two wives, because they were such incredibly wonderful women, both of them. And I was perfectly aware of the fact of my essential interest in males, but I really liked them and loved them, slept with them, had sex all the time. So I wanted to get that across. So that's what I did. I wrote this up, and then the manuscript, by a very interesting set of circumstances, got to the attention of Jonathan Galassi. Those of you who are professional writers, this whole story will drive you crazy. No agent, no submission, just they came to me. So he read it, and he said, no, it's much too personal, in a very pleasant way. Lovely writing, but it's too personal. So that was the end of that. And I set it aside. And then I thought I'd write a memoir about my years of teaching, and so I set to do that. And I'd no sooner done that, Then a friend of mine at a dinner party seated next to Galassi, this is now 20 years later, brought me up for some reason. I came up with the conversation, and she brought up the fact that I was writing this memoir of my teaching, and he said, oh, you know, that was a mistake. I should have taken that memoir. So she gave him my email. He got in touch with me. And of course, it was great because I could bring it up to date, because by this time, I had met my third spouse, who is a male, and we then got married as people, and we have been together 23 years, and so it was a wonderful final chapter. I mean, I'm still alive, but I ended it when I was 80, because, you know, let's face it, the party is so over. So that was it, and so then we had to think about a title, and I jokingly said, well, what about Blowjob and Iowa Boyhood? And Mr. Galassi is a very serious person, so he said, I don't think so. And so then I came up with this idea of my husband and my wife, wives, you know, catchy. And, of course, always in mind that browsing in bookstores, of course, there are no bookstores anymore, so there's no browsing. I don't know if you browse on Amazon. I don't know what you do. Anyway, so that was the title. Well, I will point out to you something which may or may not interest you, is my first marriage, Mary, has 22 pages devoted to it, which was a marriage that lasted 4.5 years until her death. Then I married Penny. And Penny, I was married to for 20 years, and she gets 74 pages, a much longer time, and much more detailed, obviously, and more anguished in every way. And then, now I've been with Richard 23 years, and he only gets 10 pages. And a lot of people, particularly gay people, said, well, what is this all about? You know, back to, you know. And the fact of the matter is that Richard and I have had this very pleasant relationship, and, you know, we're old, and it's nice, and it's pleasant, and every day is pleasant, and one day after another goes along fine. So, what can you say? It's just pleasant. But I will tell you a wonderful thing, which isn't in the book, but I can't remember. There's a little Sturm und Drang along, or whatever Sturm, whatever that word is, I forget those. When we're in the car together, we fight. So when we go to Florida in the winter, going back, we fight so much I can't even describe. So Sunday I'm flying down, and I don't care what the hell he does. That's marriage in action. In any case. So that's how that part of the title came to us. And then I dreamt up the other part, which is A Gay Man's Odyssey. And, of course, Odyssey, because I'm a classicist. And I wanted to evoke those images. And there's a lot about classical antiquity in this book, because it was very important to me as a young man when I first discovered antiquity, as a student taking ancient Greek and courses in translation and so on and so forth. And I discovered the tragic sense of life, because I'd been raised as a Christian, and albeit an Episcopalian, a sort of quality Christianity. All that business about sin and redemption isn't in, of course, a tragic sense of life. And the great thing about antiquity was it suited what I believed life was all about much more than Christianity had. And of course, as you will read in the book, I was thoroughly humiliated and I consider mentally maltreated by the Episcopal priest in my town, who, for perfectly valid reasons, since he was in the business and it is against the rules, objected to the fact that I was having all this sex with men. But I couldn't very well continue to observe a religion that had that kind of nonsense as part of their doctrine. So I was very happy as a 19-year-old to pick up classical antiquity, and I reveled in it intellectually and spiritually. and eventually studied it so carefully that I became a professor of it. But it, on the way to that, there was a funny moment that I was living in New York. I was 18 years old. I decided I wouldn't go to college, so I just started a little bit, and then I dropped out, and I went to New York, and I was living the life of whatever, and working in New York. And then, unfortunately, I got gonorrhea, and I was so frightened of this experience that I went back home to my hometown because I knew the doctors there, and I didn't want to... I mean, I know New York is full of doctors, but I felt so embarrassed. And a friend of mine, then this is written up in the book, and a very good friend of mine in Madrid who was reading the manuscript, an Italian woman, who was, I'm not going to do it in Italian, she said, "Allora, so the reason you're a classicist is because you had a venereal disease." We owe that, which I thought was an interesting way of putting it. In any case, so that's how the Odyssey got into the title. And then I would like to also point out about classical antiquity, which you can read in this book, is that my attitude toward it has changed over the years. I was very conscious of it, or I wasn't conscious in the beginning, of course, but everyone, when I studied it at Harvard, was sort of an upper-middle-class WASP, and then the people you'd meet in the business were sort of upper-middle-class WASPs or old-money people, and so on and so forth, and it really fit into what classics seemed to me was all about at that time. And it was much later when I taught at Lehman College in the Bronx that I realized how in some ways it didn't really work for people because it doesn't really describe the oppressed and the humiliated and the degraded who were so often the people who'd come from that background who were my students. And I could sense a sort of a kind of listlessness. And I realized that they were not really identifying with all these arrogant, exploiting, overbearing people such as Achilles and Patroclus is a case in point, and how he is constantly misrepresented by classicists. I so love it, you know, this little sweetheart. Well, you know the story of how he got to the court of Peleus. He was a young fellow in his hometown, and he was playing chess with his cousin or something, and he killed him because he got annoyed at him while they were playing chess. You know, I didn't mean to. This is what the text, I didn't mean to. It was a mistake. Well, I used to volunteer teach in Norfolk State Prison, and I met a lot of young men like that who didn't really mean to kill somebody, but like they did. And I don't think it's just the sweetest. I don't think Patroclus is one of the sweetest little people who ever came along, so I think he was probably a big brute, just like all the rest. In any case, their goal was sort of to wipe the dispossessed off the stage, so that I began to have a lot of problems with the literature as I got older, just from that perspective, although I find it fabulous in other ways. Now, I'm going to get around to gay man. I wish I hadn't put it in the title, because when I went, I went down to Barnes & Noble when the book first came out in Union Square, and they have this table right down the front, new nonfiction, and I thought, and I went to, I found it isn't there, so I went over to the table, I said, "Where is Charles Roan Bynum?" Blah, 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 and she said, "It's in gay studies on the fourth floor." Talk about being in Perda, or whatever. Well, you can't get, Barnes & Noble won't change it either. I mean, it's an edict, and the decree went out from their central office that it will be in gay studies all over the world, that's too bad, but I wanted to have a larger audience because I really meant it for everybody because I think it's a very interesting story and it has nothing to do with the fact I'm gay. I mean, I am gay, so that's a fact, but it's not what it's all about at all. And I find particularly women I know I don't mean women I know personally, but I get comments from women who really like it a lot. And they obviously are not making an essential identification with gay males. So, I mean, I feel happy that there is that kind of audience. And, of course, one of the things that bothers me, and I bring this up as an aside, I don't have to be paying attention to time. Oh, my God, it's almost, oh, no, it's, I'm right. One of the things that bothers me is this whole idea of gay culture, which I can't resist mentioning, because there is a book out now, which was down on the table at Barnes & Noble. I don't want to pass judgment on Barnes & Noble, but called How to Be Gay by a man named David Halperin, and it essentially says you can't really be gay unless you identify with Joan Crawford and Mildred Pierce. And I find that idea so repulsive, I can't even begin to go down there. And Bette Davis and that whole shtick, which doesn't seem to me to have anything to do with anything. And if I were to define what I think a gay person is, it's not an interest in that, but, and I don't believe in gay culture for another thing, and the reason I don't is because gay people invent themselves over and over again because they have nobody to turn. I mean, when some 15-year-old boy discovers that he's gay, I know nowadays, I'm sorry, I'm going back, when I was young. Nowadays, of course, it's everywhere you turn. But when I was young, they couldn't talk to their parents. They couldn't talk to anybody. So they had to say, well, they didn't know they were gay. There was no such word. I mean, what am I? And they had to invent themselves from scratch. And I think that essentially gay people do that, and that they have to always discover themselves. And one of the ways in which I wrote, one of the ways in which I developed that in this book was by talking so explicitly about my sexual experiences when I was a teenager, because you have to understand, I didn't understand. I didn't understand about sex. I was just like any kid. I didn't understand why I was attracted to these other males. And since it was a very young age, if you've read the book, I mean, I was in a prep school, and these things, you could act on them, and there was no, at least in my own situation, there was no disapproval. I just didn't, it took me years to understand, well, not years, but I exaggerate a lot. It took me some time to realize that the world didn't like this. And I think that that it's very important for that reason to make it clear how I was experiencing males sexually, because I was having an experience each time that was quite inventive to me. I had no models for these things. And then, you know, when I was 21 years old, out of the blue, I met this woman, and 1 hour later, out of the blue, I'd never in my life had the slightest interest in women. I said to her, we should get married. And she said, okay. And, well, you read it. And we did. And it's bizarre. And so then I had to describe my whole experience of sexual intercourse with her, because I was had been having sex since I was 15 years old. And all of a sudden, wow, this is very different. But I mean, you like laugh at this, but I mean, this was an extraordinary spiritual, emotional, psychic development in my life. It made me into an entirely different person. And it has nothing to do with gay or straight or anything. It was just encountering an entirely different experience. So I wanted, it was very important to me as a human being. And so I wanted to make that very clear. So I talk about sex more than you perhaps would want to read. I have to say that my daughter, one of my daughters, she is married to this fellow, and they got married not too long ago, and I met his mother on that occasion, and she's my age, old money, 82, terribly nice, very polite and refined, not loud as I am, very tasteful. And she said to her son, I want a copy of that book. And he came to the book party I had up in Cambridge. He came with a copy and said, would you sign that for Mom? I said, I don't think this is really the book for your mother. And he said, she wants it. And I told her there's some sex in it. And my daughter said, look, if she can get past the blowjob, she's easy sailing after that. So so I don't know. I don't know if he ever gave it to her. I don't know what she's... Anyway, I don't know how I even got onto that point. I wanted to say, yes, I was talking about my engagement with the sexual act. And one of the things that it people don't understand about a gay, about a male who is attracted to other males, which is myself, is you don't realize as this starts out, and you don't know how to define it because you're attracted to all sorts of males, all the males you find around who are attractive, and you don't understand that. I mean, there are no categories. You're not in a gay bar where everybody supposedly is interested in that sort of thing, and you don't quite understand it, and then you have these other experiences, and I'm going to read a passage from this celebrated tome just to let you know, and I want you to think, those of you, male, let's talk about males, heterosexual males, let's talk about them. Let's talk about a 20-year-old heterosexual male who is at his health club and he's in the locker room with 30 naked women walking back and forth. That's the experience. Except the 30 naked women would know that he was an interloper and they would hold a towel over themselves. But the other guys in the locker room have no thought about this. So it's a lifetime experience to spend to constantly, well, not at 82, but to your reactions, you see. But I want to read this passage because I think it's very funny, but it also is kind of poignant. This is a scene from the days when I was at Stanford. Stanford's recreational swimming was segregated by gender, which was more or less universal 50 years ago. Males swam nude, ostensibly because the original swimsuits were made of wool, which shed lint into the filter system and was thus to be avoided, and Stanford continued the custom. I swam at noon almost every day. I was a professor at them, and then climbed onto the permanent spectator bleachers to lie down and nap or eat my lunch. Over time, a number of my students got in the habit of joining me on the bleachers where we had some pretty high-class bull sessions. They were not only bright young men, they were very earnest. So it was a kind of Socratic moment for me, lounging about, talking into the face and crotch at the same time of any number of lovely naked lads. One fellow used to arrive, flop down in front of my body, stretched out on a bleacher, straddle the bleacher, and present his delicious penis and testicles on the level of my head, about 2 feet away, open his sandwich bag, and munch away. We once discussed it years later and decided that it was an unconscious response on his part to an instinctive feeling that I was attracted to him, and subconsciously, he wanted to gain the support and favor of the alpha male. It just is the kind of experience which straight males don't ever have in their life. So it was an interesting aspect of my experience, that world of men who are all around me. And another thing that I would say that identifies or defines gay males as opposed to a love of Joan Crawford and Mildred Pierce is that they are, of course, on some level fearful, paranoid, and filled with a kind of self-hatred they have to work out. Now, when I gave this talk up in Cambridge, I compared them to the feelings that African Americans have and Jews have in general, and the Jews in the audience that I knew personally were all nodding their head back and forth. I don't know if any Jews in this room would have that same reaction, but I think there is a problem if you have experienced hostility for generations plus the historical reality of the world in which we live now, you don't think you're ever safe. And I certainly, though I'm perfectly comfortable, he said, trembling and shaking, but I don't think, and I have a very good friend, it's so funny, when the Mariel boat people came over here from Cuba, you may remember that, well, they built all these sort of enclosures and so on to house them, and I said, oh, my heavens, and then they were finally admitted into the population, and he said, that's where they're going to put us someday, you just wait. That actually didn't cross my mind, but this is a perfectly sensible professor, if that is not a contradiction in terms, but in any case, I thought that was interesting. And I think the other thing which infuriates many gays, but I'm going to say it anyway, is the irony of the unfulfilled orgasm, because an orgasm is meant to produce a baby, somewhere biologically. And that's an interesting fact, that it doesn't do that in homosexual intercourse, or it has no way of doing that. So on some level, it seems to me, of course, I stand here saying that with four children, but they were all mistakes, as you will read in this book. That's a very difficult thing, and that's a difficult part of the book. It's a difficult part of my life. They're wonderful, wonderful people, and they're very loving and very accepting of me, have been ever since I told them, which oddly enough had never really crossed their minds before, although by this time they were in their late teens, early 20s. And I know my sons, you know, I'm not what they probably would have chosen for a father, but they're okay with it, and I think they think I'm pretty weird, which I'm pretty weird anyway, even if I didn't have this peculiar aspect to myself. And the funny thing about this is, or amusing, my brother, who has got to be so butch, football, high school, all these things, you know, hey, he's got a gay son, three gay grandchildren, and he keeps saying to me, what about your sons are straight? Your sons are straight? Your grandchildren are straight? I said, yes, they're all straight, straight, straight. Drives him up the wall. Anyway, fun times at our Thanksgiving dinners. I didn't know how the children would react. I didn't know how they'd react to this. And the older boy said to one of the daughters, she reported to me, he said, why didn't Dad talk more about us and what wonderful times we had, the fun we had all the time? He doesn't talk about any of that. And she said, it's about him growing up and being gay. It's not about us. So he didn't talk about all that. But I was happy to hear he did, behind my back, talk about how he had fun times. It's interesting. I'm sure you all have, those of you who are parents, it's so hard with children. But, you know, if you have this, and I wrote something like this, you wonder how hard is it for them. And I was so happy, now I'm going to say this the wrong way, so when I rewrote it and added Richard, my husband, into the mix, I was at peace with the fact that my second wife had died, because I had problems talking about her in the earlier version because she was still alive, and I didn't want to hurt her. And you know, it's very hard to talk about a relationship, and she was so betrayed by me, not sexually, because she knew before she ever married me, but you know, I don't care how much you know. And you know, and somewhere along you think, oh my God. Plus, I'm a total nut, so that's neither here nor there. In, I mean, gay or straight, I'm a manic. You know, I'm so cuckoo. And I don't think she didn't bargain for all of that. And the interesting thing about our relationship, which I didn't mention this in the book, is all that we are both from old WASP families, and thus we are thoroughly repressed people. I mean, you may not think that I'm such an hysteric, but we never once, this is 20 years of marriage, we never once mentioned the fact that I was gay, though I told her before I ever slept with her, but we never brought it up again, ever. In all of the Sturm und Drang, the horror. And I know she talked to other people. It was like my mother once, that horrible, if you've read the horrible day when she confronted me with this when I was 16. We never mentioned it again. And that's the world I grew up in. You don't ever talk about the realities. You just don't do it. So this marriage, so I didn't say anything. We didn't talk about it. So I was so glad, in the sense that she was dead, I could say, I don't mean to say now I can talk about that bitch the way I wanted to, but I mean I could talk about how she had to act out herself to get some life because she was married to this, in some sense, monster. Not because I'm gay, but because I mean the whole thing. Well, you'll read it. Give a copy to your mother-in-law. a book for everyone in the house. This is the perfect Christmas gift. Anyway, well, let's see. I'm going to let you ask questions in a minute. Don't panic. Or maybe you'll think, oh, yilly. Now, the other thing I have in this book, I want to say that, well, I talked about this, that you have to develop a way of acting with all people, as that swimming pool experience describes. And so I've had all my life to have a relationship with straight males, and I have a great number of close straight male friends over the years. And then I have women friends, and I feel that I wouldn't want to be any different than them, because I feel I'm very close to both straight males. Obviously, I'm close to gay males, and I'm close to women. And there's so many things I feel I can talk about with males when they'll let their defenses down, which they sometimes will do with me, because I'm not a challenge, because I'm not in the world with them. If, you know, I'm not in the competition. And they can put me into some other category if they're not afraid of me. So we can develop friendships. And I, in my lifetime, had two very bizarre experiences. I used to swim at the Women's Y in Cambridge at the 6 o'clock hour, which was co-ed. And there was this male there. I was then 50-something, and he must have been 35. And he was a construction worker, unbelievably gorgeous, Italian, American, the whole thing, just you can imagine, who'd fallen off the top of the John Hancock building down when they were constructing it. He'd fallen in something like 9 stories and had to be reconstructed physically. Surgery took a long time, like a year and a half, and he was on permanent disability. So he had all these scars all over his body, but he still was unbelievably gorgeous, and he went swimming all the time. Well, he just, not physically, he just fell in love with me. I don't know what, he wanted to spend all his time with me, and he would start coming by my house so we could go to the gym together instead of just meeting in the shower room and blah, 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 and he wanted to do it. And I finally said, I can't deal with this. I can't even remember his name now. So I said, I have to tell you something. You know, I'm attracted to males. I'm gay. And he really, you know, he's standing there stark naked when I said that to him. You know, women don't realize frontal nudity for men is a big thing. And we were just standing there naked talking to each other. And I said, you know, I'm gay. Well, I have to admire him. He worked that out in his mind. And we went on having this. There was a little distance there, but we went on having that. And another time when I was working at Harvard on the buildings and grounds when I was in graduate school, this young man who just gotten out of service, he fell in love with me. He was also working on the buildings and grounds. And I was married to my first wife then, and he would just wanted to spend all, you know, come to dinner, you bring your wife, come to dinner, blah, 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 blah. And I finally said to him, I can't spend so much time with you. I'm incredibly sexually attracted to you, and it's painful. That was very hard for him, because he wanted to have this friendship, but it took him about 6 months to figure out how to proceed with it, because he'd never had an experience like that. It's interesting. All these things are interesting to me, and I've had such great relationships with males. Many, many strange. A lot of this is in the book. Let me see. Enough of this. Now let's see what else I wanted to say to you. Oh, I wanted to. There's a lot about my teaching in here, as well as being a classicist, and I describe 4 moments. Which I will always treasure. You know, I've taught for 42 years, and a lot of those years were, as you can imagine, it's like working as a bank teller or any other dreary job, though I used to, in my darker moments, say it's just like some woman on 42nd Street in red satin hot pants trying to get those businessmen on their way home to Jersey. You know, because you have to take the students you get, and she had to take the John she gets. You can't reject. You can't say, you have halitosis, now go away. And you can't say to your student, you're stupid, I don't want you in my class. But so you, It's really amazing how teaching is like prostitution. I mean this in a positive sense. It's very hard to teach. It's not easy. It's not an easy. But 4 times, I had the most delirious classes, and I think in 42 years to have had those 4 experiences, I'm very, very, very lucky. The others weren't all bad, but those were really great. In any case, I'd describe those. And I think that teaching is the other great erotic experience. And it's non-sexual, but it's certainly erotic in your interaction with the students and your love of them and their love of you and what you are giving them and what they're giving you. And if you surrender to them, and I've had so many kids say such intelligent things to me who made me rethink, and I've written that in the book, I mean, just made me rethink what I was talking about. And I owe it all to these unformed intellects who just were wonderful. So anyway, that's erotics of another sort. Now let's see. Oh, I could go on for hours and hours and hours. Don't you want to ask questions? Now you're... If you don't ask questions, you fail the course.
Yes.
Good. Yes. That's in some detail in the book. It's just because my wife and I, and I'm, this is a level of stupidity that, well, I want to say, let me say something else before, that one of the things Maureen Corrigan, who wrote the review on Fresh Air, which is marvelous, and I read it every morning, she said, one of the nice things about the book is he doesn't draw lessons from his experience. It just happened. So I don't know why, but we were before the pill. Just briefly, my first wife vaguely used a diaphragm every so often, but she was diabetic, so she never got pregnant. And I didn't know anything about these things. And then the second wife, and we drank so much and we screwed all the time. And you have to fix up that diaphragm if you're going to keep doing it over and over. I took the girls to get fitted years later, or to have something done, whatever girls have to have done for them when they're 16 or whatever they are. And I was idly sitting there reading the literature, and it said how to use a diaphragm. And I said, my God, now I learn. It's a very famous line in Greek tragedy, which is repeated often. Arte manthano, at last I learn. This is, you know, Oedipus and the whole thing's falling. Oi! Or that's another Greek culture. Oi! But that's almost like Greek tragedy. Oi moi, that's Greek. And then, oi! Now I find out. Anyway, so every year we had another baby. It was just, you know, we might have been... God... It's just insane. But they're lovely, and they're all a year apart. Well, there was a miscarriage 1 year. And we always have these 50-year birthday parties, so after the second one. So everybody said, well, now we get a year off. And I said, no, we're going to have a birthday party for space. That was so we had a 50th birthday party for space. And I said, the best of the lot. Space, my favorite. And they laugh about that. But I'm sure... Like the Virgin Mary, they laid it up in their heart. Anyway, another question? Yes, ma'am.
I worked in a boys' school.
Yes.
The culture has changed so much in terms of homosexuality. Could you just talk a little bit about how you would see a person growing up now who's gay as opposed to...
Oh, well, I think I can, even though I'm not in a prep school now, but I am very struck with it. You know, there is, now because there are these well-defined categories, there's gay and there's straight. And because there's gay and there's straight, I think young males are very fearful of having any kind of contact whatsoever with another male. And I extend it to something that to me is so bizarre, if you go into most most locker rooms nowadays, these, well, I used to swim when I taught at the city. I used to swim at John Jay College because I live near John Jay. Now, these are kids. These are boys. They're all going swimming, and then they go in the shower room, and they won't take their swimsuit off. They will not. And then there are all these old farts like myself, you know, professors, who all parading around stark naked all the time. Because we're in the generation where you're naked all the time. I mean, what is with this? And none of those boys would take off a thing. Never, never. Because they're terrified of having someone look at them. But let's go to another place, because I swim in many places. I used to swim at Harvard, which is a much more educated group of young men. And that always fascinated me, because in the latter years when I swam at the Blodgett Pool, the locker room and the shower room, those guys have absolutely no hesitation parading around naked and realizing that a lot of the men are looking at them, because they accept that. That's the way it is now. So they're not upset about it, because they don't feel like it's catching if somebody looks at them. But it's a real change. And, of course, it's so interesting to me, because fellatio, to use the word, which I understand every girl in high school is doing it on her boyfriend, or even friends. Forget about boyfriends. That's so different from my day. I mean, one of the reasons I made such inroads on all the guys in my high school, because they had no sexual outlet at all. They couldn't sleep with any of the girls in the school. And I used to give them all blowjobs all the time. And it's so funny. This book is out. And the girls who were in my class, you know, they're all like me. They're all 82 years old. They've been writing me these emails. I didn't have any idea you were so active. They're all coming. I'm going out to Iowa City, where I come from, for a reading, and a contingent is coming. I can't wait. Hi. In any case, I think in a prep school nowadays, a young man would say, I am gay. And then everybody would say, that's respectable. You know, you are. African American, you are gay, you are an Indian, you are whatever you are, so you're fine. And they wouldn't be an issue with it. I would imagine, I really don't know, but because, you know, they're all sleeping with their girl. I mean, these boys, everybody's sleeping from the time they're, I don't know, whatever. So it's very different from my day. I was at a friend's house the other day. I was so shocked with what she said. Her daughter came downstairs and with a young man who was someone she was studying with, study date, and not a boyfriend, just a friend. And he left, and the daughter disappeared from the room. And my friend said, I know she gave him a blowjob. I know she did that. I thought, this is the 80s. Oh, please. But I was so shocked that she would even think of that. She was annoyed, but it wasn't like, I can't. In my mother's day? Well, it's a long time ago. Anyway, other questions? Quick, ask a question. Yes, sir. Oh, it's Tony. Yes.
The connection, I'm intrigued, the connection between the reward of having kids and orgasms, when you say that the gays, they get steamed up because are you diminishing their...
Well, I think they feel that way. I mean, I don't think that... I don't know. I think it's just an interesting fact, and it's the truth, and it may make some people feel unfulfilled or unhappy. Well, that's why you're here. Mm-hmm. Well, it may be totally wrong. That was just my. I'm often struck with that. I've always been struck with that with anal intercourse, that it doesn't produce a baby. And I didn't have children because I wanted to. So I can't say that vaginal intercourse for me was the road to fatherhood. It wasn't. It wasn't at all. But there was no doubt that that was somewhere part of the picture. I knew that much about biology. And of course, then it became this horror story, because we couldn't stop having sex all the time. We were very over-sex people, and we just had all these people. You think about it, all those people back in the olden days, in the 90s, these women had 14 and 15. You know, my mother did not like children, it is very clear to me. She had 16, no, no, wait, 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 six and six is what? That, she had 12 pregnancies, and six of them were miscarriages. And I used to think, though I don't know how you do that, I had a feeling she always went and pushed furniture around the room or whatever. Because my father wanted to have all these babies because he wanted to keep up with the Catholics. He thought all these immigrants are coming here and having these horrible big families. Oh, he would have been so sad at the election. You know, I think about if my parents were like, Supreme Court, six Catholics and three Jews? What happened to the Mayflower? Black president? What's going on here? I mean, it's when you think about it, or some of you who come from those terribly bigoted families of that other generation, lucky they're all dead, but I mean, I can't imagine how my parents would face this world. And of course, I mean, if they just were plopped down into it, but it's odd, isn't it? Or perhaps you don't think about it, but anyway. More questions. Well, you can all go home, too, but ask a question. No questions? Yes, ma'am. She feels bound to because she's in the employ of this place. Yes. Yes.
Well, that's true, but I also really love the book, and I just want to enthuse about it a lot also.
Oh, good. That's not a question. Here's an endorsement.
No, it's an endorsement, not a question. I sort of have a question. I was really... my breath was taken away by the bit in the book where, as you mentioned earlier, you became somewhat disenchanted with the classics.
Yes.
Taught all your career because of this different perspective. And I thought, I mean, that was part of the reason in the introduction I said you rediscover and reinvent yourself,
yeah,
et cetera. But so that's an element of it. But it seems like you talk a lot in the book about teaching and its various rewards, but it seems like the university system in which you're teaching doesn't come in for a lot of love. And
well,
I don't know if you could talk a little bit.
I think I don't know how to answer that honestly. Because I think I'm a very difficult person, and because I never had a father, my father died when I was a small child, I never learned what is very important for men to learn, which is to knuckle under to men. I never had that experience. I was always the smart, darling, mother's little darling. And then, of course, I didn't do sports because I was crippled. Well, you read the book. I was crippled. And then, of course, I was this maverick guy giving blowjobs to everybody in town. So I wasn't exactly the norm, and I didn't do the things the other guys did or whatever. So I attribute some of my unhappiness with the academic system to the fact that I don't know how to deal with men as father figures, and I was a professor in the days when all professors were males, and they were father figures and authority figures, and I'm just not... I wasn't good at that because I was subversive by nature. I mean, everything my life led me to be subversive, not only because of no father, but all the other things there as well. And I did have I had a wonderful woman as the chair in Wheaton College, and that was good, but of course it was sort of a piddling place. And then I went to Yale, and I had a marvelous chair there whom I really adored, who was a very cynical, witty, clever, very famous Frank Brown, archaeologist who went on to become the director of the American Academy in Rome. Totally cynical, totally self-serving, just a marvelous man. I'll tell you why. Let me tell you why. And I'll compare him to the next one I had. I went in, I was asked to teach, I think, now I'm going to forget, Pliny the Elder, some Latin author. My field is Greek. But I mean, I obviously have to know how to do Latin, but you know, the first year, and then I get this assignment of whatever it was some author that I don't think I even had read in graduate school. It was some ridiculous author, and I said, Frank, is there some way we could change? Why? I don't think this is a good idea. He said, I don't care if it's a good idea. He said, you're low man on the totem pole, and you're going to teach it. Very pleasantly. I mean, he wasn't nasty about it. He just said, screw you. And I liked that, as opposed to the chairman at Stanford, Brooks Otis. Oh, Charlie, we must do the Christian thing, and it is important. that you teach. God, what such a phony. Beyond phony. And I couldn't stand him, and he couldn't stand me. I mean, he could not stand me from the day he met. Well, you read that. He kept saying, is he Jewish to everybody? He must be Jewish. He must be Jewish. I think, and I say in the book, I think he thought I was the male equivalent of Bella Abzug, which means that. Anyway, he was so phony. So that was a problem for me because I didn't get along with him very well. And I was very subversive and very transgressive and always trying to get the better of him. And I had this colleague named Ted Doyle, who was this Boston Irish, who he was the most wonderful human being in the world, And he was always subverting Brooks, too. We were subverting him together. Those were the great days. I want to tell you, those of you, are anybody, some of you are teachers, but you're all old ones like you. They're all retired, but there are no young people. You know, it was wonderful back then. It was marvelous. I'll give you a typical day. Thursday, Ted and I set out in his little car. We went up to Woodside, to the Woodside Inn, and had three martinis. Then we wove our way up through Portola Valley to this restaurant called Rosati's, where we had a couple of bottles of wine and roast goat. And that was the life of Professor By on his way to tenure. Needless to say, Brooks Otis said he would never support me for tenure, so I didn't get tenure out there. In any case, then I went to BU, and of course, then that was wonderful, and I had the 6 years, the greatest time ever in my life when I was the chair. And I say in the book, and I, you know, those were the days, my friend, we thought they'd never end, and then, of course, they hired Dr. Silber, and we won't go into that nightmare. So that was the end of that. I mean, I'm not alone in that. He destroyed everybody. Except his friends. And then I went to Lehman, and that was a lot of fun, too. That was great. That was absolutely marvelous. And I was at the graduate school, and that wasn't so much fun. I'm not a very, I'm not cooperative. I'm not a good person to have as a colleague, unless we're having a good time. I mean, I don't know. Those people in the graduate school, I felt so sorry for them. The other people, they couldn't wait till I retired. I mean, as I say in the book, I bet they were opening champagne all evening long. I walked out of there the last day. Nobody said goodbye. Nobody gave me a farewell party. And I'm sure they're all like, way! You know, it was like that wonderful thing that Saturday Night Live when Chris Rock or one of those people, some black, he gets off the bus and I'm sure that the bus driver starts playing the piano and all the people open bottles and there's no more blacks on the bus, no more blacks on the bus. So I'm sure that was exactly the way it was at the graduate school when I walked out the door the last day. And does that make it clear to you? Okay. Yes, ma'am.
Can you say more about working
with prisoners? Oh, well, that was a great experience. I'll tell you, that really was one of the... That was great. I did that for 12 years, 10 or 12 years. Norfolk State Prison, medium security. They would only let people who were murderers take the course, not murder per se, but they had to have a life sentence, which just means, what, 10 years, 15 years, because it took that long to get a BA degree through this program, because they had to take very few courses at a time, and they had to take whatever they could get, and I was the classicist, so, you know, that was a course, so they'd take that, and they got 3 days off their sentence or something for every hour the course met. I mean, there was some incentive for these guys. It was fabulous. It was just fabulous. I'd never met guys like this before, really. Well, I had, and that's not true, but they're kind of spooky in some ways. They're very, very bright, and a lot of them were just so psychotic. I went in there with that feeling that prisoners are all misjudged, and they're really wonderful people who've been misunderstood. not at all. They're violent and awful people often, but there are a lot of wonderful people, and they had such great things. I had a woman in Cambridge. She was the director of the Cambridge Ensemble, which put on such brilliant, I can't even discuss how brilliant the stuff was there, and I got her to bring her Aeschylus, her Oresteia, down to the prison, and we got permission. I mean, I won't go through what we had to go through, and they had to be fingerprinted and blah, 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 but we got in there. And the men set up a room. It was a classroom. They wouldn't allow any special rooms, so they were in a classroom, and the lights were crap and so on. Well, it, at Begin, it didn't start out right because these people wore their costumes and they were in leotards. Well, these men had never seen, women had no brassieres on, so you know, they could see their nipples and they could more or less see their pubic hair through the, and they went berserk and snickering, and you know, so we had to calm that down. But then they did, then they accepted it, and it was a very powerful truncated version of the thing. It went on for, I don't know how long, maybe an hour. And then, oh, it was so sweet. They had some cookies and so on. It was going to have a little reception. They were wonderful, and they'd say to these people, I can see why the son killed the bitch. This is Clytemnestra. You know, I came back from Nam, and I took all her teeth out because she was fucking everybody in town. I mean, they really knew this play. I mean, they understood it. And all this other stuff, they really, kill. Yeah, kill, baby, kill. That's the name of the game. It just made the teaching, now you laugh, but it made the teaching so different. I mean, you weren't talking to middle-class children about, you know, hamartia and, you know, the tragic meaning of life and so on. You were talking about people who'd lived it and were vicious, hateful in what they'd done, and they often knew it. And there was this one guy, I just adored him, in a drug-induced madness, he killed his wife and his two daughters. And he was a destroyed human being. Let me tell you, the sweetest guy you'd ever want to meet. And I'll tell you, there's a kind of a happy story here. He again, eventually got out of prison, and he studied very hard while he was there, and he was a person who came from a very limited background. He was a black Hispanic person, just had no background for anything. And he got a BA, and he went on and got an MA in life, and he went on and got a PhD. Well, he must be retired, but he became a professor. And he lived like a monk. He never had another woman in his life. He never had any life. But he was so sweet. I'm going to start crying. He was really a dear. Anyway, yes, ma'am.
When you were teaching drawing in prison, was there a text that you thought worked particularly well with that, or an ancient text?
Well, they loved Bob Fagel's, you mean like that?
Yeah.
They loved Bob Fagel's Aristeia, and that's the one Joanne used for her Cambridge Ensemble production, and I've seen that on the stage several times. I think that reads so well in performance. I think it is brilliant, just brilliant. It's one of the, to my mind, one of the great translations because it works on stage. And if you are, well, you know all about this because you're a big authority on this stuff. They read poorly, most of the men. So there was a lot of storytelling and not so much reading of text as there might have been, and parsing those choral passages. It was interesting because they were getting what they were getting, and the first day, this one group said, "What are we doing in this class?" Another one said, "We're here because we're getting time off the sentence." And I said, "Well, yes, that. But what are we going to get from you?" I said, "Well, I don't know, you know, truth and beauty and so on." I said, "Well, you're going to see how middle-class people live. I'm a middle-class person. You're not. And this is what middle-class people think about ancient Greek tragedy. And so you will learn what I think about." Then we got into other aspects. It was quite interesting. And I told them about paying the mortgage and all the things you do in them. They were appalled at the horror from their perspective of the obligations that went on. And in the life of middle class and the problem of getting your children into college and on and on and on. They couldn't believe people lived like that. It's interesting. Anyway, did that answer your question? Yes, ma'am. Sir.
I can't even see that far.
I have a question about your, when you were talking earlier about when you were a teenager.
Yeah.
And you said you didn't realize, I think you said you didn't realize you were gay.
Yeah.
And that you just thought it was perfectly normal.
Yeah. It's an amazing thing. Now, I have to tell you here, this is an amazing thing. I went to this high school, I had the sex with these two guys at Andover, independent of each. One didn't know about the other. And they never said boo, so it seemed to me like a perfectly reasonable thing to do, and I knew that sex was, to some extent, just different. I mean, I hadn't had this before because I was a youth, so I knew from that to that extent, but I had no sense that it was socially not approved in the way it was. And then when I started having sex with these two boys in my high school who were lower class boys, and they started talking, and then that, my reputation went down. And at the first, and you can read about it in the book, it was a nightmare. But I wasn't bullied. And I described that in detail. I wasn't bullied because I came from a very wealthy family. I was very good looking. I had lots of money. I had a car, which very few kids, and I was incredibly witty and social. Well, I mean, you can laugh at this all you want, but I mean, it was true. And I don't know what it is. And I go to my high school reunions. I've been going up to the 60th. How do you like that? We still have them. We're all friends. We really do. And we had a good time. And, you know, I was blowing half these kids, too. But I don't know why. They didn't. They didn't. The lower class boys of the time, or the parochial school children, you said this visibly, people you never know, they were more hostile. Oh, you're asking. Okay, they were more hostile. Now, you're asking. Because we used to beat up the kids. We used to beat up the guys in my, and they were my age. And I said, well, I just wasn't beaten up. I don't know. Everybody loved Charlie. Yes?
One thing I was surprised about is that you never came across another young man.
I know, isn't that weird?
The whole time?
Never.
All those people?
Never. I know, I can tell you right now, I know all the gay males in my high school. I know from the males, these little pallid creatures who never married and sort of lived at home and never did anything. I mean, but they didn't say anything.
You never
figured. Later on, but I never was. Oh, no, when we were in school. Right. But they wouldn't have gone near me. I mean, they were terrified of me because I was so flagrant and out and this horrible creature. No, they would, I think of when I see them at the reunions, I say, hi. They're terrified. I quite agree with you. Where were all the gay people? And I was saying in the book, I mean, I was in the University of Iowa, was right across the river, and I used to go to the art museum to their movie series. Why didn't I meet any gay guys there? And I assume it's because I was a kid. And, you know, the students weren't 19 and 20 back then. They were like 25, 26, 27. I think there was a, you know, I don't mean that conscious of molestation like we think about it today. I think, you know, or whatever, I don't know. Nobody ever propositioned me, and I didn't get the picture. Well, once in a while, you can read the book once in a while, but I mean, I didn't get it, and I never got it. It's so funny. And I've had a lot of therapy. I mean, I've had psychiatrists and I'm like, up the wazoo, and they've never had any good ideas about these things. So. I have no idea. One thing I don't care, I don't think you need to figure out your life. I think this Maureen Corrigan is absolutely right to draw lessons from your life. Just live it. And because everything you say is a myth. It's like everything we say is a myth. And if you've been a teacher, you know that because I've taught ancient culture. It's Charles Rowan Bye talking about his life and times translated to antiquity. What do I know? You know, what does anybody know? Well, you know, there are a couple of classes. They know what I'm talking about. All those, and those people, I mean, I was taught by this great Werner Jaeger, this German crypto-Nazi, who came here because he married a Jew, and so he had to leave Germany, much to his regret, and his sons from the first marriage were in the Luftwaffe. But I'm not saying he was pretty, but he had a point of view, which his idea of classical antiquity was sort of like 30s Germany, maybe, in some ways. That's one point of view. Then I had a teacher who was Tom Rosemeyer. He was another Jew from Germany who got out of the country, very liberally went to Canada, and he was a student of a man named Eric Havelock, and his idea was that ancient antiquity was kind of a socialist experiment. You know, here's Jaeger saying, ach ja, you know, this other, they all, and it's the same country we're talking about, it's the same history we're talking about. And then there's me, and I saw it as just a nice middle-class Iowa Episcopalian experience. I mean, but we all translate it into those terms. That's what teaching is. It's called mythologizing. And it's nothing wrong with that as long as you know it's myth. That's all you're doing is making a myth. And the kids are going to make their own myth, and somewhere in there is a reality, but you're never going to really. I mean, there's many. But don't ever draw lessons from anything. That's why when I said, you know, in the beginning, I say in the book, I am going to stop. It's all over. Somewhere I say, what was that all about at the very beginning after 80 years? What was that all about? But I don't want to answer it. I just want to ask the questions because who knows? I have no idea. Anyway, we should probably stop, shouldn't we? Yeah, stop. You are very kind to come out.